Morning birds. Jeez, what is that in the sky? Is that snow? No. My ride's here. Cue the horse. Maybe we jumped again just a little bit, but you know, it did snow a little bit this morning, and it is sleeting as we go on the air here at 5 after the hour here in Chicago on Tuesday, the 24th of November. And hello from all of us here, and thanks for joining us and waking up here. You know, I'm in an authentically good mood. We actually have good news today. Well, honest to goodness, here we go. The presidential transition will officially begin. After weeks of delay, the Trumpsies are going to authorize a key agency, the one that we called just a couple of days ago. I'll tell you more about that. The latest on Biden's cabinet, big deal there. A number of big deals. This is just good news. I'm gonna savor this. Dateline Washington: President Trump's government today authorized President-elect Joseph Biden to begin a formal transition process after Michigan certified Mr. Biden as its winner. It's a strong sign that the president's last-ditch bid to overturn the results of the election was coming to an end. That's right. Mr. Trump did not concede, and he vowed to persist with efforts to change the vote, which has so far proved fruitless. The president said on Twitter on Monday night that he accepted the decision by Emily W. Murphy, the administrator of the General Services Administration, to allow a transition to proceed. We called just a couple of days ago. I don't think that our call pushed him over the edge, but, you know, it might have helped. Something else was happening is the a number of business and world affairs leaders were denouncing the delay in allowing the peaceful transfer of power. It's a holdup that Mr. Biden and his top aides said was threatening national security and the ability of the incoming administration to effectively plan for combating the coronavirus pandemic. That followed a key court decision in Pennsylvania, where the state's Supreme Court yesterday ruled against Trump and the president's Republican allies, stating that roughly 8,000 ballots with signature or date irregularities must be counted. In Michigan, the statewide canvassing board with two Republicans and two Democrats voted 3-0 to approve the results. One Republican abstained, and that officially delivered to Mr. Biden a key battleground that Mr. Trump had wrested away from the Democrats. In a statement, Johannes Abraham, the executive director of Mr. Biden's transition, said that Ms. Murphy's decision, this is the head of the GSA, was a needed step to begin tackling the challenges facing our nation. So this is all good stuff here. I just dropped a stack of notes here. I want to make sure you know about it. Let me just apologize. You know what? I'm going to say this for the last time here. For the moment, it's just me. Yeah, well, and it's you. It's you and me here. Here we go. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who is retiring, again, the retiring Republicans, issued his second call in recent days for a prompt transition. So here we go. This is this is the show for the moment, hosted by an old white guy. And we were talking about an old white guy who just got himself elected president. And this is good news for America. They're going to nominate Janet Yellen, if confirmed by the Senate. Janet Yellen will be the first woman Treasury Secretary in the United States. An extremely accomplished woman, a very smart lady. She was head of the Federal Reserve. Treasury Secretary is more or less the country's economic ambassador in the world. So this is a big deal, and it's a good thing for all of us here. The last few years with Trump attempting to manipulate the Fed and all these things, this just isn't a good thing. So we congratulate Ms. Yellen and hope for the Senate confirmation to go without a big hitch. Here we go. The other top cabinet roles, Alejandro Mayorkas, M-A-Y-O-R-K-A-S, Mayorkas, will be the first Latino to lead the Department of Homeland Security. And Avril Haines, A-V-R-I-L-H-A-I-N-E-S, Avril Haines, she's going to be the first woman to be the Director of National Intelligence. That's a big deal. Mr. Biden is also expected to create a new post of International Climate Envoy. That's going to go to John Kerry. Now, John Kerry was, of course, the former Secretary of State, and he was the chief negotiator with the Paris Climate Change Accord that the Trumpsies pulled us out of. So, this is all good stuff. This is all good stuff, and a lot of it has to do with sort of just replacing the government that we got rid of. So, anyway, good stuff. Good stuff. Good stuff. I feel like we're back. I feel like we're back here. We're back. We're back. We're America again. So that's the hard news. The soft news is, I'm gonna cry. Wait a minute. They rescued an owl from the Christmas tree in New York. Details coming up.
With me, brand new day, fresh new weather. to you. Take it, die.
Coming our way. It is finally. It's 14 after the hour. It's Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago. It's Gary Lee Wright. Please be careful if you happen to be driving. Ugh. It is sleeting as we go on the air here. It's going to dry off a little bit, we hope. The rest of the day kind of a mess. Tomorrow we'll have an 80% chance of precipitation. Looks like Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, is going to be somewhat clear. So there you go here. I am in a good mood. I think things are coming our way here. A quick note on the hard news here. This is a big deal. A major break with the president. General Motors has announced that it would no longer back the administration's efforts to nullify California's fuel economy rules. So as Trump's just gone on in history. The administration that reversed everything good about global warming, we'll walk back that and some of this other stuff. So, anyway, today is the 24th of November. Charles Darwin's Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection was published on this day. I'm gonna get into that. Not only is that a tremendously interesting and important historical event. It also gives me a chance to talk about the Darwin Awards. Now, but the Darwin Awards, you know, these are the people that actually remove themselves from the species, and we don't always miss them. So, we have a story about I think the winner of the 2020 Darwin Award attempted to climb Mount Fuji in street clothes. On this day, Dan Cooper hijacked a plane in 1971. I'm going to zip into that. If you were my age or around that time, this was an incredible story. This guy, his name was Dan Cooper, we think. We don't really know his real name. He hijacked a plane. He extorted $200,000. That was a lot of money back in 1971, ransom. And then he jumped out of the plane over Washington State. And then he was never seen again. They never found Dan Cooper. They never found the money. Nothing. So that happened on this day. Freddie Mercury passed on this day in 1991. We'll get into that. And something very interesting about bacon and eggs. So all of that coming up today on the program. Should we get the scoop on Charles Darwin? I know, I'm a sucker for British accent. Here we are. Ma'am?
How do we explain how animals have evolved over time? Charles Darwin, the British naturalist and geologist, famously answered this question in his book, On the Origin of Species, which proposed the mechanism of evolutionary change within animal species. He called this theory natural selection. Darwin's key argument was that environmental pressures define what species look like, how they behave, and why they survive. Species usually evolve over thousands of years, but occasionally, rapidly changing environments give us cases of evolution sped up to a human timescale. So how about an example of evolution in action? Introducing the peppered moth. Habitat: English birch forests. The moth had a mottled white body and wings as camouflage protection against predatory birds. Within a species, Darwin said, there is always natural species variation. In the case of the peppered moth, some moths were a darker color than others. Although this variation existed, the darker moths were rarer because they were more likely to stand out and get spotted by hungry birds. Their lighter counterparts survived in greater numbers and were therefore more likely to pass their light-winged trait onto the next generation of moth. Darwin called this the struggle for existence. In other words, how different characteristics, in this case color variation, provide advantages or disadvantages. Some will win and some will lose. That's the struggle for existence. During the Industrial Revolution, soot from factories burning coal darkened birch tree trunks in areas of forest closest to industrialized towns and cities. Here, we see the struggle for existence change. Now, the lighter-colored moths are more likely to be spotted by birds and eaten, and the darker moths are the ones more likely to survive. As a result, the darker moths are able to breed more prolifically than the lighter ones. This sort of environmental change drives species to adapt to their environment and shift one way or another. Over time, it explains how populations have evolved into new species from a common ancestor. For instance, if birch forests around industrialized towns remained covered in soot, we would, over time, see the peppered moth develop two distinct subspecies, a light moth adapted to cleaner areas of forest, and a dark moth adapted to industrialized areas. The Origin of Species was published in 1859, and Darwin's theory of natural selection revolutionized the way we study animals today.
Wow, bravo! I that was quite interesting. How about that? Darwin published on this day in 1859 the On the Origin of Species, and that leads me to make a note here. Have you ever heard of the Darwin Awards? Darwin Awards are described, I just looked this up, as a tongue-in-cheek project. The Darwin Awards are, I don't know how to put this. Well, they award to some lucky or unlucky recipient every year the distinction of having removed him or herself from the species by doing something incredibly stupid. So we're in an era now where people are like leaning off of hotel balconies when they're hammered to take a selfie of themselves, right? All right, those are the things those are the minor instances. I just looked up who won the 2020 Darwin Award. Let me just see what I can do about this. Okay, all right, let's put a clock on this. You want to? Okay, here we go. All right. In the end, cold was not the culprit. My hands are numb, but I must operate my smartphone, muttered 47-year-old Tetsu to his live stream audience as he skidded and stumbled up the snow-covered Shubashiri Trail of Mount Fuji. said he, I wish I had brought heat packs. And then he was heard to say, wait, wait, I think I'm slipping. 62 miles west of Tokyo, iconic Mount Fuji is one of Japan's three holy mountains, 12,000 feet high, volcanic summit visited by religious pilgrims, mountain climbers, sightseers. The trek is cold and slippery even during the brief summer season when amenity stations are staffed and available for the benefit of climbers. In the off season, the stations are closed and mountain conditions are downright hostile. A winter climber needs the proper gear, climbing experience, and a booster pack of common sense. Ted Zak, alas, lacked all three. Sorry, Tetsu is his name. He was wearing street clothes, suitable for a typical October day in Tokyo. He's carrying nothing more than a pair of climbing poles. Tetsu fired up his smartphone and he proceeded up the Shubashiri Trail, which incidentally most climbers use only for descent. They had like a wrong way sign. Oops. Anyway, live streaming for the Nico Nico video sharing platform. He entitled his video, Let's Go to Snowy Mount Fuji. In hindsight, the title implies that Tetsu considered Snowy Mount Fuji just as safe as a ski resort or a Christmas tree farm. But, well, viewers began tuning in and he was up there and then the last thing they heard was, oh, I think I'm slipping. Don't be a Darwin Award recipient this year. Freddie Mercury passing on this day in 1991, just one day after he announced that he had tested positive for HIV. Yeah. We will continue to consider rock immortal, music immortal, people immortal, artists immortal. That's the philosophy here. It's 27 after the hour. I wish I were immortal. We have a day to enjoy here. We really do. I'm looking out the window. It looks like the weather is abating a wee bit. So that's good here. Let's see here. What else is going on? Wow. Before the end of the show here, I will get to this. This is slugged as the Christmas miracle of 2020. It's all about how they rescued an owl in New York. But wait a minute. Not just anywhere in New York. They pulled it out of the New York City Christmas tree. So I'm gathering that. We were printing off details for you on that. That is cooking up today. And we have a, you know, this is interesting. Let's just do this real quicker. I was talking to Natasha, our producer, about, just stuff that relates to mornings, and the concept of breakfast came up. I try to force myself every morning to choke down a protein bar before I go on the air. Remember back in the old days, I used to go and, I don't know what I was thinking, but I would actually go and eat a full breakfast because I had to, it was like a 4-hour show. So you have to be energized. I go and I eat poached eggs and toast and 3 cups of tea. So boy, I was really talking fast when I showed up. I try to relax a little bit. I'm down to the protein bar. Anyway, I was looking at some of the things that we are eating now and we did not eat forever. And one of the things that's interesting, do you like bacon and eggs? Oh, man, where's my sizzling sound effect? Bacon and eggs, for many people, that's breakfast, right? When you say breakfast, it's bacon and eggs. Eggs have long been a popular breakfast food, of course. Fresh eggs were often available early in the day, but their partnership with bacon is a 20th century invention. It's really hard to, it's hard, and I have full disclosure, man, I used to be a vegan, kind of a vegetarian a little bit, ovo-lacto-vera. Having said all that, it's really hot, it's almost impossible to avoid bacon, and I'm not sure that you should here. Anyway, Americans ate very light breakfasts in the 1920s, a public relations guy, his name is Edward Bernays, persuaded doctors to promote bacon and eggs as a healthy breakfast in order to promote sales of bacon on behalf of Beechnut, a packaging company that had diversified into food production. I worked in Iowa, or Iowa is a huge pork producer. In fact, in Iowa, look this up. It sounds like one of those trivia things I just made up. But when McRib goes back on the menu, the agricultural economy of Iowa is greatly enhanced. So, a shout out to my friends in Iowa. And so, yeah, back to bacon. Bernays convinced some doctors to sign a letter recommending a hearty breakfast and publicize this conviction in newspapers with bacon and eggs presented as the ideal start to the day. So put down the tofu. It's all right. You want to hear about that? All right, let's hear Edward Bernays. Got to remember how long ago this happened. Mr. Bernays, you have the floor.
Many years ago, our client was the Beechnut Packing Company. We made a research and found out that the American public ate very light breakfasts of coffee, maybe a roll, and orange juice. We went to our physician, found that a heavy breakfast was sounder from the standpoint of health than a light breakfast because the body loses energy during the night and needs it during the day. We asked the physician, after telling him why we were talking to him, would he be willing, at no cost, to write to 5,000 physicians and ask them whether their judgment was the same as his, confirmed his judgment. He said he would be glad to do it. We carried out a letter to 5,000 physicians. Obviously, all of them concurred that a heavy breakfast was better for the health of the American people than a light breakfast. That was publicized in the newspapers. Newspapers throughout the country had headlines saying 4,500 physicians urge heavy breakfast in order to improve health of American people. Many of them stated that bacon and eggs should be embodied with the breakfast, and as a result, the sale of bacon went up, and I still have a letter from Bartlett Arkell, president of Beechnut Packing Company, telling me so.
We are automating here. Should we automate? Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Because I got hungry. Huh? No, it's either over or scrambled. Forget poached.
We'll be right back.
legs. ZZ Top, 22 before the hour here on Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago, where it is nice outside. Well, kind of nicer than it was. It's no longer sleeting here. Today being the 24th of November, boy, I saw some major stuff here that we were talking about, and the Darwin anniversary and all this stuff. But there was a news story that happened that I just looked up here. And I am going to say that if you're around for this, this was one of those just wild stories. Let me hit it. It happened on this day. D.B. Cooper. D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper, is a pseudonym of an unidentified man who hijacked a Boeing 727 aircraft in the airspace between Portland and Seattle on the afternoon of the November 24th, 1971. The man purchased his airline ticket. Just, you know, and as I go through this, I'm reading from Wikipedia. As I go through this, dig the differences in, wow, everything that are between the lines here. Okay, goes in, uses an alias, but because of the news miscommunication, he called himself Dan Cooper. He became known as D.B. Cooper. He extorted $200,000 in ransom. That's equivalent to $1 million to today. And then he parachuted to a what? He parachuted to an uncertain fate. Let me see. I'm going to zip through this if I can ask you to indulge me here. I'm looking at screens here. I remember this vividly. I just wanted to make sure that I got it right here. Many FBI agents are of the opinion that Cooper probably did not survive the high-risk jump, but his remains have never been recovered. The FBI maintained an active investigation for 45 years after the hijacking. Despite a case file that's grown to over 60 volumes, 6-0, no definitive conclusions have been reached regarding Cooper's true identity or whereabouts. The events, all right, okay, how about this? Thanksgiving evening, it's November 24th, 1971. He's a middle-aged man. He walks in carrying a black attaché case. We don't have a picture of him, but there's one of the, you know, the police sketch artist. There's one of those that everybody knows about. He goes into the flight counter of Northwest Orient Airlines. Anybody? At Portland International Airport, he identifies himself as Dan Cooper. He uses cash to purchase. Wait a minute. He uses cash to purchase a one-way ticket on Flight 305. It's a 30-minute trip north to Seattle. Cooper gets on the aircraft. It's a Boeing 727. Takes a seat. He was a quiet man who appeared to be in his mid-40s, wearing a business suit, a black tie, and a white shirt. Oh, he orders a drink, a bourbon and soda. All right. The flight was about one-third full. After takeoff, shortly after, Cooper hands a note to Florence Schaffner, a flight attendant situated nearest to him in a jump seat attached to the aft stair door, assuming, she said later, she thought he was trying to hit on her, that he was passing her his phone number. He drops the note into her purse. Miss, you'd better look at the note. I have a bomb. Now back up. Wait a minute. This guy walked again, 1971. This guy was carrying a briefcase when he got on the airplane. No checking necessary. He had a briefcase. He gets on. The note was printed in neat, all capital letters with a felt tip pen. The exact wording is unknown, because Cooper later reclaimed it on the plane. But Schaffner recalled that the note said that Cooper had a bomb in his briefcase. So Cooper told her to sit beside him. Schaffner sat down, asked to see the bomb. Cooper opened the briefcase long enough for her to glimpse something that looked like a bomb. Anyway, He asks for the following: $200,000 in negotiable American currency, 4 parachutes, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the aircraft upon arrival. So the pilot had served in the Army Air Force, contact Seattle-Tacoma, and the other passengers, they did not tell them what was happening. So anyway, they circle around Puget Sound to allow the Seattle police and the FBI sufficient time to assemble Cooper's parachutes and the ransom money. This is like, wait a minute, am I telling you a movie? This actually happened. So you've got the cops on the ground. They're rustling around trying to raise $200,000 in cash and 4 parachutes. And then FBI agents assembled the ransom money, unmarked bills. The passengers were released. Cooper was informed that his demands had been met. And let me just let me wrap it up here. During your refueling, Cooper outlined his flight plan to the cockpit crew. He was on a southeast course toward Mexico City at the minimum airspeed possible without stalling the aircraft. It's kids, don't try this at home. The Darwin Awards, try not to, don't, even if you've got a parachute, you don't want to try to jump out of a jet. The wing flaps were lowered. The cabin remained unpressured. They got him going there, and at some point, he bailed. He bailed out. And as I told you, they have searched that area for, what did I just say, 60 volumes worth? So the guy bails out somewhere between Washington State and Oregon, and he's got the 200 grand. And I mean, it's one thing if the guy, you know, bails out and they say, you know, but oh, he bailed. Oh, he's got $200,000. So believe me, they looked for him. So what happened? We don't know. That is the story of D.B. Cooper, who bailed out on this day, 1971. I'll bet right now, if somebody were listening to me and didn't know the story, they'd say, you know, where is that again? Let's go and, oh, come on, we'll take the day off. We'll go look. It's probably in a tree.
Somewhere.
Fine Young Cannibals. It's a good thing. It's 12 before the hour now. It's Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago on Bleat.network. Thanks for joining us this morning on a day in which we have all kinds of interesting stuff to gravitate toward. You know, I just shared with you the story of D.B. Cooper from 1971. Today is Billy Connolly's birthday. I want to play a clip from him on the Conan O'Brien show. And as luck would have it, the phrase comes up, well, you know, it was the 60s, man. Anyway, 1971 was officially still the 60s in a lot of people's minds. So you got to factor in D.B. Cooper and jumping out of airplanes with $200,000 of cash and stuff like that. When you think about, oh, man, it was the 60s.
His wife didn't know half the stuff I was texting about, and but we smoked the Bible once.
You and Jerry Rafferty smoked the Bible.
Well, it was the 60s, you know. And...
You know, the 60s doesn't just explain everything. I shot a camel. What? It was the 60s. We were all doing it.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
No, but you would have loved it.
Yes, I would have.
You would have gone to hell with me.
Yeah, yeah.
But in those days, you did these sort of folk clubs, and they would say the fee, it would be X amount of money, plus accommodation. Well, that meant the couch or the floor or something.
Right.
So we were in this guy's house, and we were all drunk, and I had some hashish. Goodness knows how it got in my pocket. Pakistani black hashish. You're ducking under low bridges with this stuff. And I got it out towards the end of the night, and I said, anybody get any papers? Or skins, as we used to say, us cooler guys. And nobody had any papers. And I said, well, I saw a movie once, and it was a prison movie, and they were smoking the Bible.
Apparently, using the paper, yeah.
If you get a page of the Bible, you can get a reasonable cigarette paper. So the guy who owned the house was up in his bed, drunk. And I said, I'll go and ask him if he's got a Bible. So, and I was kind of drunk as well. I went into the room and I said, you, he was sitting up reading, this guy, pissed, you know. I said, you wouldn't happen to have a Bible, would you? He says, yes, yeah, I've got a Bible. I said, you want it? I said, I just want a couple of pages.
Amen.
There's a big old hole. Goes right through the soul. This old shoe and the water on the ground ain't got no place else it's found. So it's only got one thing left to do. Just creep on in. Creep on in. And once it has begun, it won't stop until it's done. That silver moon came a little too soon. Oh, for me to bear, it shines brightly on my bed, and the shadows overhead won't let me sleep as long as it's there. Just creep on in, creep on in. And once it has begun, it won't stop until it's done. So as long as you're around, I got no place else you found. There's only one thing left for you to do. You just creep on in. Creep on in. And once you have begun, you don't stop until you've done sneaking in. And once it has begun, you won't stop until it's done sneaking in. And once it has begun, don't stop until it's done sneaking in. Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Creeping in.
Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Sneaking in.
Creeping in. Gonna keep creeping on me.
Creep.
Creeping in.
I should have made that some sort of a quiz to identify the voices. It is who? That's Norah Jones and Dolly Parton. I was playing Norah Jones yesterday. I think played Sunrise at the top. And I looked at the record. And it has a duet with Dolly Parton, who made the news. And we scooped everybody, did News Baron Aaron with the information that she had been an investor in Moderna in this vaccine. So anyway, we thought we'd tie it all together. It's called Creeping In with Dolly and Norah. 5 before the hour, it's Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago on Bleat.network. I promised the Christmas story of the year. I know it's too early. I'm not even ready for Thanksgiving yet. How about this? Ellen Kalish, used to getting calls about taking in undomesticated animals at her nonprofit group, which is called Ravensbeard Wildlife Center in Saugerties, New York. Anyway, a woman called her on Monday asking if she could rehabilitate an owl. And she was willing to help. We have an owl? Do we have an owl anywhere? There we do. All right. No, it's not. It's just it's this. So it's all right. It's a stand-in owl. Anyway, where's this owl? The woman told Ms. Kalish it's at the Christmas tree in the Rockefeller Center. You know where that is, all right? You watch NBC. That's Rockefeller Center there. Kalish is the founder and director of the center. She told the Washington Post, "I've been doing this for 20 years. Never heard a story like that. The tale of the rescued owl, who has naturally become dubbed Rockefeller, became the silver lining of the Rocky debut for this year's version of the Christmas tree, which apparently looks a little bit shaggy. The world was busy mocking the tree. Somebody saw this owl and spotted the creature buried somewhere near the base of the tree." That's right. The woman called Kalish, who said her husband also works for the company in charge of this task, and thought that the owl might be injured because it was glued to the tree's base. So anyway, they bring the owl home. This is beautiful. They nurse it. They bring it back. They around 5 p.m. on Monday, the woman hands her a cardboard box with the owl inside. He looked up at me, and I was relieved to see that he was looking in relatively good shape. That's right. He traveled for the 3-day trip. They took him to the clinic. They gave him water and left 2 mice in a plastic pet carrier. Rockefeller the owl. Yeah, I don't have time to make eggnog right now, but I will. Natasha Rodriguez produced this widecast.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. Watch them grow, they're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful.